Chapter 12, The Penalties of Success. The Dharma, in the sense of the Buddha's teaching, has been described in a number of different ways. The Buddha himself described it as a raft and as a path. It was a raft inasmuch as it was something to be made use of and then left behind, and a path inasmuch as it consisted of a series of steps or stages that had actually to be traversed. Probably the best known formulation of the path is that in which it is described as eightfold, as consisting of perfect view, perfect motivation, perfect speech, perfect action, perfect livelihood, perfect effort, perfect mindfulness, and perfect meditation. Perfect view is view that is in accordance with reality, while perfect motivation and the rest are perfect to the extent that they are in accordance with that view. Perfect view is not easily achieved. It is achieved only with the help of, or on the basis of, right view, which is the mundane counterpart of perfect view, in the sense of being the expression of that view, or better, that vision, in conceptual terms. Perfect view or vision itself being of the nature of a supra-conceptual, transcendental, transforming insight or gnosis. The development of right view, and therewith the abandonment of wrong view, that is, views that are not in accordance with reality, thus is of crucial importance. Without right view, it is difficult to make progress on the mundane Eightfold Path, and without systematic progress on the mundane Eightfold Path, it is extremely difficult to achieve perfect vision, and thus to make progress on the transcendental path, and attain, ultimately, nirvana or enlightenment. Right view can be expounded, and wrong view is exposed as such through the medium either of the spoken or the written word. The spoken word, by virtue of its more immediate impact, is often the more effective medium, and much of my time was therefore spent giving lectures. Besides lecturing regularly at the Vihara and at the Buddhist Society, I gave talks to the members of the provincial Buddhist groups, and on different occasions addressed divinity students, young Jews, philosophers, farmers, and theosophists. I always prepared my lectures, at least mentally and in outline, and they always contained a strongly doctrinal element. I also enjoyed giving them. In giving them, I was communicating the Dharma. I was sharing my own deepest convictions and insights. But much as I enjoyed giving lectures, whatever the nature of my audience, I most of all enjoyed lecturing at the Vihara and at the Buddhist Society, particularly at the Vihara. There were several reasons for this. Apart from the circumstance that in both places my audience consisted mainly of Buddhists, or at least of persons sympathetic to Buddhism, there was the fact that I lectured at both of them regularly. This meant that I got to know my audience, and they got to know me, so that as the weeks and months went by, and one lecture succeeded another, a definite rapport was established between us. It also meant that in every lecture I was able to build, at least to an extent, on all the lectures that had gone before, knowing that certain topics had already been dealt with, and that the larger, more regular part of my audience was already familiar with them. This was particularly the case when I gave a whole series of lectures, as I did that winter at both the Vihara and the Society, speaking at the one on the Bodhisattva ideal and the six paramitas every Sunday, and at the other on the developed Buddhism of the Mahayana on alternate Fridays. Other lectures were on such subjects as the Middle Way, Tantric Buddhism, and Buddhist meditation. Many of the lectures, including those that made up the two series, covered ground that was covered in a more detailed and scholarly manner in my book, A Survey of Buddhism. This made it possible for the more studious or more inspired members of my audience to follow up the topic of the week's or fortnight's lecture by turning to the relevant section of my book. The survey itself, of course, had grown out of a series of lectures. I had given the lectures 10 years ago in Bangalore to a mainly Indian, predominantly Hindu gathering. I had given them without making any concessions to my audience, and now that I was speaking to a mainly English, predominantly ex-Christian audience in London, I made no more concessions than I had made then. On both occasions, I beat the drum of the Dharma and blew the conch shell of the Dharma vigorously and without compromise. And on both occasions, my efforts met with a positive response, the only difference being that in England, people expressed their appreciation in a more restrained fashion. There was one lecture that did not meet with a very positive response. This was an independent lecture, that is, a lecture that did not form part of a series. It was on the Pure Land. I gave it at the Buddhist Society, and like the lectures that made up the two series, it covered ground that was more adequately covered in the survey. In Bangalore, so far as I can remember, my exposition of the Mahayana conception of the Pure Land, the archetypal realm where enlightenment is more easily attained than on earth, had met with as positive a response as the rest of my lectures on the Mahayana schools, of which it formed part. But in London it fell flat, probably because the subject was new to my audience and perhaps confusing. Not all the lectures I gave covered ground that was covered in the survey, either at that time or later on. In some, I explored aspects of the Dharma I had not explored before, at least in lectures, while in others I gave expression to recent developments in my thinking. The first time I did either of these things systematically in a series of lectures was when I gave 4 lectures on the meaning of conversion in Buddhism. In these lectures, given at the Hampstead Vihara, I dealt with conversion to and within Buddhism in terms of going for refuge, stream entry, the arising of the will to enlightenment, and turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. The immediate cause of my giving thought to this question was that some English Buddhists spoke of their having been converted to Buddhism. Some even claimed to have converted themselves. Though the fact that I had until recently been involved in the movement of mass conversion of ex-untouchable Hindus to Buddhism must also have played a part. Short as the series was, compared with the 2 others I had given, it was an important one. In it, I not only gave expression to some of the ideas that had come to me as a result of my realization over the years of the central importance in the Buddhist life of the act of going for refuge, I also paved the way, with the help of the concept of conversion, for the further development of those ideas. In particular, I paved the way for what I have elsewhere described as that radical reduction of stream entry and the arising of the will to enlightenment, and even of turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, to going for refuge, which characterized my later Buddhist thinking. Success is not without its penalties. The fact that I was giving so many lectures and that more and more people were coming to hear me, though they still came in their dozens, not in their hundreds, gave rise to certain problems. There was a problem of logistics, for instance, and there was a problem of space. The logistical problem was due to the fact that I lectured both at the Hampstead Vihara and at the Buddhist Society, as well as elsewhere, and that the programmes of the 2 establishments had to be coordinated. Usually Muriel Dorr, the Society's black-browed, rather intense meetings secretary, and I did this between us. But whenever there were arrangements for the joint celebration of a festival to be agreed upon, or a common policy on some matter of general Buddhist concern, Christmas Humphreys came instead. The first time this happened, he drew from his briefcase a list of proposals which he proceeded to run through at top speed, prefacing each proposal with, "I'm sure you'll agree that," and ticking it off and passing on to the next one before I had a chance to say anything. When 5 or 6 proposals had been dealt with in this way, I interrupted him with, "Wait a minute, Toby, I'm not sure if I agree with that." Whereupon he looked up from his list with undisguised astonishment. Evidently, he was accustomed to having his proposals accepted without demur, and the possibility of my actually wanting to discuss any of them had not occurred to him. But though inclined to be dictatorial, he was no fool. By the time our meeting ended, he had realised that I was not to be steamrolled into agreement and had changed tack accordingly. At our subsequent meetings, therefore, agreement was always preceded by discussion, in the course of which a proposal, whether his or mine, might be amended or even dropped. It was at one of these meetings, I think, that there arose the question of my place in British society. Just how it arose, I do not remember, but at one point Christmas Humphreys told me, in all seriousness, that I ought to regard myself as being the Buddhist equivalent of the Vicar of Hampstead. If I could do that, he seemed to think, I would be doing very well for myself, besides bringing credit to British Buddhism. Though I had yet to meet the Vicar of Hampstead, who, for all I knew, was a very worthy gentleman, I did not relish the idea of being the Buddhist equivalent of a Christian cleric, Anglican or otherwise, nor did I see why the area of my jurisdiction should have to correspond with his. Britain was my parish, and I had no intention of allowing myself to be confined to any one part of it. Space was a problem only at the Vihara, for whereas the Buddhist Society's meeting room held between 90 and 100 people, the Viharas, which doubled as the shrine room, could hold little more than half that number. At first this did not matter, but as the weeks went by and as attendance at my Sunday lectures gradually increased, difficulties arose. People had to sit on the floor on either side of the green and gold shrine, on the landing outside the door, and even at the top of the stairs, from which position it fortunately was still possible to hear my voice and follow what I was saying. Obviously, if we wanted to continue holding lectures at the Vihara, the meeting room would have to be enlarged. As we, the Sangha Association committee members and I, definitely did want to go on holding them there, the Sangha Trust agreed that the partition wall between the meeting room and a second, smaller room at the back should be demolished and collapsible doors installed. This would give us an L-shaped room capable of seating 90 people that could be divided, whenever necessary, into two. While the work was being done, lectures would be held amid the 18th century splendours of Burg House in the heart of Old Hampstead. On my recommendation, the contract for enlarging the meeting room was given to a young builder called Krishna Gamri, one of a small group of Indian Buddhists, all followers of Dr. Ambedkar, who sometimes came to see me. He was badly in need of work, and I wanted to help him. Though I was now living in England, I had not forgotten my ex-untouchable friends in central and western India, many of whom were still suffering at the hands of the caste Hindus, and spoke about them and Dr. Ambedkar and the movement of mass conversion to Buddhism whenever I had an opportunity. Earlier in the year, I had spoken about them at Linacre House in Oxford, when I addressed the Hammarskjöld Society on what Buddhism has done for the untouchables in India. But words were not enough. I wanted to give some practical help on however small a scale, and the least I could do, now that I was at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, was to urge the Sangha Trust to give the contract to Krishna Gamri. It did not take him and his labourers, all immigrant Indian Buddhists, long to demolish the partition wall, but that was the easiest part of the job. Soon it became evident that there was much more to demolishing a wall than demolishing a wall. It also became evident that Krishna Gamri had had much less experience of building work than, in his eagerness to secure the contract, he had led me to believe, and that he was, in fact, quite out of his depth. I, therefore, had to become personally involved and ended up virtually supervising the project. There was the district surveyor to be consulted, floorboards to be taken up, the number of joists doubled to take the weight of 90 people. Above all, there was a 20-foot steel girder to be inserted beneath the ceiling where the partition wall had been and across the whole width of the building. As it was too long to be manoeuvred up the narrow stairs, we had to hire a crane and swing it in through the window. Miraculously, not a single pane of glass was broken. Morris became almost ill with anxiety during this exercise, and even I felt a little worried,
since I knew no more of building work than Krishna Gamre did, and had only my common sense to guide me. But eventually the job was done, the collapsible doors having been hung and the carpet relaid. I was able to go down to Camden Town and buy the additional wooden folding chairs that would now be needed. Krishna Gamre had estimated that the work of enlarging the meeting room would take altogether 2 weeks. In the event, it had taken more than six. Besides my ex-untouchable friends in central and western India, there were my Nepalese and Tibetan friends in Kalimpong. I had not forgotten them either. In particular, I had not forgotten my servants and disciples at the Triyana Vardhana Vihara, the interdenominational monastery I had established on the outskirts of the town 7 or 8 years earlier, who continued to be financially dependent on me, as did the Vihara itself. Previously, I had supported them out of the donations I received and from my remuneration for articles and book reviews. But now I was living in England, these sources of income had dried up. If I was not to have no alternative but to return to India, I would have to find a way of raising funds where I was. Having sounded out Anna Phillips, Alf Weil, and a few others, all of whom were anxious to keep me in England, I set up a small, informal organisation, the Friends of the Triyana Vardhana Vihara, the members of which all contributed a small monthly sum towards the upkeep of the monastery and the support of its inmates. Among the 24 members, no greater number was required, were the President of the Buddhist Society and the Chairman of the Sangha Association. Though I was the principal speaker at the Hamsas Vihara, I was not the only one. Bangalo and Vimalo also spoke there occasionally when they were in London, as did some of the more knowledgeable members of this Sangha Association. Since the lay speakers had a poor delivery, not that Vimalo was a shining example in this respect, besides being deficient in other ways, I launched the speakers class, as it was called. Membership was open to all who were willing to prepare and give a 15-minute talk, which would then be collectively criticised by the other members of the class. There was no honorary membership. We met every other week, initially at the Vihara, but subsequently at Christmas Humphrey's invitation, also at the Buddhist Society, and at each meeting there were 3 or 4 talks. Subjects given by me in advance included practical Buddhism, the Three Jewels, faith in Buddhism, the message of Buddhism, the symbolism of the stupa, right action, and even a teenager's view of Buddhism. The teenager in question being Alf Weil's 16-year-old daughter Christine. Soon the speakers class was not only improving old speakers but producing new ones, so that the Sangha Association was in a better position to respond to the growing demand for talks from schools, women's clubs and other groups. Our star performers, by general consent, were Ruth and Alf, whose talks later appeared in the Association's journal The Buddhist, formerly called Sangha, which I now edited. Morris either spoke very well or spoke very badly. There was no middle way. Probably because he was in the habit of doing so at college, he always spoke extemporaneously, and if he got into the right track straight away, he could be brilliant and even witty. If this did not happen, he very soon lost his way and floundered from one inconsequential point to another until he dried up and had to sit down. All the time he would be frantically twiddling a pencil or fiddling with his bottom waistcoat button. My Sunday lectures at the Hampstead Vihara were generally followed, both before and after the enlargement of the meeting room, by a little quiet socialising. People talked with one another or came up to me and introduced themselves. One evening I was approached by a young woman. She was a nurse, she said, but she also had a kind of second sight that enabled her to see when someone was suffering from cancer. She was sorry to have to tell me that I had cancer of the stomach and that I should see a doctor as soon as possible. Her words naturally gave me quite a nasty shock, especially as she obviously believed what she said and was deeply concerned for me. I therefore consulted Morris and Ruth, both of whom strongly advised me not to go to an orthodox medical practitioner, but to an acupuncturist. The acupuncturist was Mr. Van Buren, from whom Ruth herself had been receiving treatment for some time. As a result of this treatment, so she assured me, she felt much better and was bringing up enormous quantities of mucus. A tendency to dwell on this unpleasant subject was one of Ruth's few weaknesses. To Mr. Van Buren I accordingly went. He could find no trace of cancer, but said I needed treatment for my heart. He would give me a little prick then, and I could come back for the big prick in June or July. It was now mid-February, summer being the best time for the treatment of heart conditions. I little knew that when I visited him for the second time, 5 or 6 months later, I would have one of the strangest experiences in my life.